Isabel to give up the use of the term as designating the critique of taste, and to apply it solely to that doctrine which is true science, the science of the laws of sensibility, and thus come nearer to the language and the sense of the ancients in their well-known division of the objects of cognition into iotheta kai noeta, or to share it with speculative philosophy, and employ it partly in a transcendental, partly in a psychological signification. In the science of transcendental aesthetic, accordingly, we shall first isolate sensibility or the sensuous faculty by separating from it all that is annexed to its perceptions by the conceptions of understanding, so that nothing be left but empirical intuition. In the next place, we shall take away from this intuition all that belongs to sensation, so that nothing may remain but pure intuition, and the mere form of phenomena, which is all that the sensibility can afford a priori. From this investigation, it will be found that there are two pure forms of sensuous intuition as principles of knowledge a priori, namely, space and time. To the consideration of these, we shall now proceed. Section 1. Of Space. SS 2. Metaphysical Exposition of This Conception. By means of the external sense, a property of the mind, we represent to ourselves objects as without us, and these all in space. Herein alone are their shape, dimensions, and relations to each other determined or determinable. The internal sense, by means of which the mind contemplates itself or its internal state, gives indeed no intuition of the soul as an object. Yet there is nevertheless a determinate form under which alone the contemplation of our internal state is possible, so that all which relates to the inward determinations of the mind is represented in relations of time. Of time, we cannot have any external intuition, any more than we can have an internal intuition of space. What then are time and space? Are they real existences? Or are they merely relations or determinations of things, such, however, as would equally belong to these things in themselves, though they should never become objects of intuition? Or are they such as belong only to the form of intuition, and consequently to the subjective constitution of the mind, without which these predicates of time and space could not be attached to any object? In order to become informed on these points, we shall first give an exposition of the conception of space. By exposition, I mean the clear, though not detailed, representation of that which belongs to a conception, and an exposition is metaphysical when it contains that which represents the conception as given a priori. 1. Space is not a conception which has been derived from outward experiences. For, in order that certain sensations may relate to something without me, that is, to something which occupies a different part of space from that in which I am, in like manner, in order that I may represent them not merely as without, of, and near to each other, but also in separate places, the representation of space must already exist as a foundation. Consequently, the representation of space cannot be borrowed from the relations of external phenomena through experience. But on the contrary, this external experience is itself only possible through the said antecedent representation. 2. Space, then, is a necessary representation a priori, which serves for the foundation of all external intuitions. We never can imagine or make a representation to ourselves of the non-existence of space, though we may easily enough think that no objects are found in it. It must, therefore, be considered as the condition of the possibility of phenomena, and by no means as a determination dependent on them, and is a representation a priori, which necessarily supplies the basis for external phenomena. 3. Space is no discursive, or as we say, general conception of the relations of things, but a pure intuition. For, in the first place, we can only represent to ourselves one space, and when we talk of diverse spaces, we mean only parts of one and the same space. Moreover, these parts cannot antecede this one all-embracing space, as the component parts from which the aggregate can be made up, but can be cogitated only as existing in it. Space is essentially one, and multiplicity in it, consequently the general notion of spaces, of this or that space, depends solely upon limitations. Hence it follows that an a priori intuition, which is not empirical, lies at the root of all our conceptions of space. Thus, moreover, the principles of geometry, for example, that in a triangle, two sides together are greater than the third, are never deduced from general conceptions of line and triangle, but from intuition, and this a priori, with apodeictic certainty. 4. Space is represented as an infinite given quantity. Now every conception must indeed be considered as a representation which is contained in an infinite multitude of different possible representations, which, therefore, comprises these under itself. But no conception as such can be so conceived as if it contained within itself an infinite multitude of representations. Nevertheless, space is so conceived of, for all parts of space are equally capable of being produced to infinity. Consequently, the original representation of space is an intuition a priori and not a conception. SS 3. Transcendental Exposition of the Conception of Space. By a transcendental exposition, I mean the explanation of a conception as a principle whence can be discerned the possibility of other synthetical a priori cognitions. For this purpose, it is requisite, firstly, that such cognitions do really flow from the given conception, and secondly, that the said cognitions are only possible under the presupposition of a given mode of explaining this conception. Geometry is a science which determines the properties of space synthetically, and yet a priori. What, then, must be our representation of space in order that such a cognition of it may be possible? It must be originally intuition, for from a mere conception no propositions can be deduced which go out beyond the conception, and yet this happens in geometry. Introduction 5. But this intuition must be found in the mind a priori, that is, before any perception of objects, consequently must be pure, not empirical intuition. For geometrical principles are always apodeictic, that is, united with the consciousness of their necessity, as space has only three dimensions. But propositions of this kind cannot be empirical judgments, nor conclusions from them. Introduction 2. Now, how can an external intuition anterior to objects themselves, and in which our conception of objects can be determined a priori, exist in the human mind? Obviously not otherwise than in so far as it has its seat in the subject only, as the formal capacity of the subjects being affected by objects, and thereby of obtaining immediate representation, that is, intuition, consequently only as the form of the external sense in general. Thus it is only by means of our explanation that the possibility of geometry as a synthetical science a priori becomes comprehensible. Every mode of explanation which does not show us this possibility, although in appearance it may be similar to ours, can with the utmost certainty be distinguished from it by these marks. SS 4. Conclusions from the foregoing conceptions. A. Space does not represent any property of objects as things in themselves, nor does it represent them in their relations to each other. In other words, space does not represent to us any determination of objects such as attaches to the objects themselves, and would remain even though all subjective conditions of the intuition were abstracted. For neither absolute nor relative determinations of objects can be intuited prior to the existence of the things to which they belong, and therefore not a priori. B. Space is nothing else than the form of all phenomena of the external sense, that is, the subjective condition of the sensibility under which alone external intuition is possible. Now, because the receptivity or capacity of the subject to be affected by objects necessarily antecedes all intuitions of these objects, it is easily understood how the form of all phenomena can be given in the mind previous to all actual perceptions, therefore, a priori, and how it, as a pure intuition, in which all objects must be determined, can contain principles of the relations of these objects prior to all experience. It is therefore from the human point of view only that we can speak of space, extended objects, etc. If we depart from the subjective condition, under which alone we can obtain external intuition, or in other words, by means of which we are affected by objects, the representation of space has no meaning whatsoever. This predicate is only applicable to things in so far as they appear to us, that is, are objects of sensibility. The constant form of this receptivity, which we call sensibility, is a necessary condition of all relations in which objects can be intuited as existing without us, and when abstraction of these objects is made, is a pure intuition, to which we give the name of space. It is clear that we cannot make the special conditions of sensibility into conditions of the possibility of things, but only of the possibility of their existence as far as they are phenomena. And so we may correctly say that space contains all which can appear to us externally, but not all things considered as things in themselves, be they intuited or not, or by whatsoever subject one will. As to the intuitions of other thinking beings, we cannot judge whether they are or are not bound by the same conditions which limit our own intuition, and which for us are universally valid. If we join the limitation of a judgment to the conception of the subject, then the judgment will possess unconditioned validity. For example, the proposition, "all objects are beside each other in space," is valid only under the limitation that these things are taken as objects of our sensuous intuition. But if I join the condition to the conception and say, "all things as external phenomena are beside each other in space," then the rule is valid universally and without any limitation. Our expositions, consequently, teach the reality, i.e., the objective validity, of space in regard of all which can be presented to us externally as object, and at the same time also the ideality of space in regard to objects when they are considered by means of reason as things in themselves, that is, without reference to the constitution of our sensibility. We maintain, therefore, the empirical reality of space in regard to all possible external experience, although we must admit its transcendental ideality. In other words, that it is nothing, so soon as we withdraw the condition upon which the possibility of all experience depends and look upon space as something that belongs to things in themselves. But, with the exception of space, there is no representation, subjective and referring to something external to us, which could be called objective a priori. For there are no other subjective representations from which we can deduce synthetical propositions a priori, as we can from the intuition of space. See SS 3. Therefore, to speak accurately, no ideality whatever belongs to these, although they agree in this respect with the representation of space, that they belong merely to the subjective nature of the mode of sensuous perception. Such a mode, for example, as that of sight, of hearing, and of feeling, by means of the sensations of color, sound, and heat, but which, because they are only sensations and not intuitions, do not of themselves give us the cognition of any object, least of all an a priori cognition. My purpose in the above remark is merely this, to guard anyone against illustrating the asserted ideality of space by examples quite insufficient, for example, by color, taste, etc., for these must be contemplated not as properties of things, but only as changes in the subject, changes which may be different in different men. For in such a case, that which is originally a mere phenomenon, a rose, for example, is taken by the empirical understanding for a thing in itself, though to every different eye, in respect of its color, it may appear different. On the contrary, the transcendental conception of phenomena in space is a critical admonition, that, in general, nothing which is intuited in space is a thing in itself, and that space is not a form which belongs as a property to things, but that objects are quite unknown to us in themselves, and what we call outward objects are nothing else but mere representations of our sensibility, whose form is space, but whose real correlate, the thing in itself, is not known by means of these representations, nor ever can be, but respecting which, in experience, no inquiry is ever made. Section 2. Of Time. SS 5. Metaphysical exposition of this conception. 1. Time is not an empirical conception, for neither coexistence nor succession would be perceived by us if the representation of time did not exist as a foundation a priori. Without this presupposition, we could not represent to ourselves that things exist together at one and the same time, or at different times, that is, contemporaneously or in succession. 2. Time is a necessary representation, lying at the foundation of all our intuitions. With regard to phenomena in general, we cannot think away time from them, and represent them to ourselves as out of and unconnected with time, but we can quite well represent to ourselves time void of phenomena. Time is therefore given a priori. In it alone is all reality of phenomena possible. These may all be annihilated in thought, but time itself, as the universal condition of their possibility, cannot be so annulled. 3. On this necessity a priori is also founded the possibility of apodeictic principles of the relations of time, or axioms of time in general, such as, time has only one dimension, different times are not coexistent but successive, as different spaces are not successive but coexistent. These principles cannot be derived from experience, for it would give neither strict universality nor apodeictic certainty. We should only be able to say, so common experience teaches us, but not, it must be so. They are valid as rules through which, in general, experience is possible, and they instruct us respecting experience and not by means of it. 4. Time is not a discursive, or as it is called, general conception, but a pure form of the sensuous intuition. Different times are merely parts of one and the same time. But the representation which can only be given by a single object is an intuition. Besides, the proposition that different times cannot be coexistent could not be derived from a general conception. For this proposition is synthetical, and therefore cannot spring out of conceptions alone. It is, therefore, contained immediately in the intuition and representation of time. 5. The infinity of time signifies nothing more than that every determined quantity of time is possible only through limitations of one time lying at the foundation. Consequently, the original representation, time, must be given as unlimited. But as the determinate representation of the parts of time and of every quantity of an object can only be obtained by limitation, the complete representation of time must not be furnished by means of conceptions, for these contain only partial representations. Conceptions, on the contrary, must have immediate intuition for their basis. SS 6. Transcendental Exposition of the Conception of Time. I may here refer to what is said above, SS 5 and 3, where, for a sake of brevity, I have placed under the head of metaphysical exposition that which is properly transcendental. Here I shall add that the conception of change, and with it the conception of motion as change of place, is possible only through and in the representation of time. That if this representation were not an intuition, internal, a priori, no conception of whatever kind could render comprehensible the possibility of change, in other words, of a conjunction of contradictorily opposed predicates in one and the same object, for example, the presence of a thing in a place and the non-presence of the same thing in the same place. It is only in time that it is possible to meet with two contradictorily opposed determinations in one thing, that is, after each other. Thus, our conception of time explains the possibility of so much synthetical knowledge a priori, as is exhibited in the general doctrine of motion, which is not a little fruitful. SS 7. Conclusions from the above conceptions. A. Time is not something which subsists of itself, or which inheres in things as an objective determination, and therefore remains when abstraction is made of the subjective conditions of the intuition of things. For in the former case, it would be something real, yet without presenting to any power of perception any real object. In the latter case, as an order or determination inherent in things themselves, it could not be antecedent to things, as their condition, nor discerned or intuited by means of synthetical propositions a priori. But all this is quite possible when we regard time as merely the subjective condition under which all our intuitions take place. For in that case, this form of the inward intuition can be represented prior to the objects, and consequently a priori. B. Time is nothing else than the form of the internal sense, that is, of the intuitions of self and of our internal state. For time cannot be any determination of outward phenomena. It has to do neither with shape nor position. On the contrary, it determines the relation of representations in our internal state. And precisely because this internal intuition presents to us no shape or form, we endeavour to supply this want by analogies, and represent the course of time by a line progressing to infinity, the content of which constitutes a series which is only of one dimension. And we conclude from the properties of this line as to all the properties of time, with this single exception, that the parts of the line are coexistent, whilst those of time are successive. From this, it is clear also that the representation of time is itself an intuition, because all its relations can be expressed in an external intuition. C. Time is the formal condition a priori of all phenomena whatsoever. Space, as the pure form of external intuition, is limited as a condition a priori to external phenomena alone. On the other hand, because all representations, whether they have or have not external things for their objects, still in themselves as determinations of the mind, belong to our internal state, and because this internal state is subject to the formal condition of the internal intuition, that is, to time, time is a condition a priori of all phenomena whatsoever, the immediate condition of all internal, and thereby the mediate condition of all external phenomena. If I can say a priori, all outward phenomena are in space, and determined a priori according to the relations of space, I can also, from the principle of the internal sense, affirm universally, all phenomena in general, that is, all objects of the senses, are in time, and stand necessarily in relations of time. If we abstract our internal intuition of ourselves and all external intuitions, possible only by virtue of this internal intuition and presented to us by a faculty of representation, and consequently take objects as they are in themselves, then time is nothing. It is only of objective validity in regard to phenomena because these are things which we regard as objects of our senses. If no longer objective, we make abstraction of the sensuousness of our intuition, in other words, of that mode of representation which is peculiar to us, and speak of things in general. Time is therefore merely a subjective condition of our human intuition, which is always sensuous, that is, so far as we are affected by objects, and in itself, independently of the mind or subject, is nothing. Nevertheless, in respect of all phenomena, consequently of all things which come within the sphere of our experience, it is necessarily objective. We cannot say, all things are in time, because in this conception of things in general, we abstract and make no mention of any sort of intuition of things. But this is the proper condition under which time belongs to our representation of objects. If we add the condition to the conception and say, all things as phenomena, that is, objects of sensuous intuition, are in time, then the proposition has its sound objective validity and universality a priori. What we have now set forth teaches, therefore, the empirical reality of time, that is, its objective validity in reference to all objects which can ever be presented to our senses. And as our intuition is always sensuous, no object ever can be presented to us in experience which does not come under the conditions of time. On the other hand, we deny to time all claim to absolute reality. That is, we deny that it, without having regard to the form of our sensuous intuition, absolutely inheres in things as a condition or property. Such properties as belong to objects as things in themselves never can be presented to us through the medium of the senses. Herein consists, therefore, the transcendental ideality of time, according to which, if we abstract the subjective conditions of sensuous intuition, it is nothing, and cannot be reckoned as subsisting or inhering in objects as things in themselves, independently of its relation to our intuition. This ideality, like that of space, is not to be proved or illustrated by fallacious analogies with sensations, for this reason, that in such arguments or illustrations we make the presupposition that the phenomenon in which such and such predicates inhere has objective reality, While in this case we can only find such an objective reality as is itself empirical, that is, regards the object as a mere phenomenon. In reference to this subject, see the remark in Section 1, SS 4. SS 8. Elucidation. Against this theory, which grants empirical reality to time, but denies to it absolute and transcendental reality, I have heard from intelligent men an objection so unanimously urged that I conclude that it must naturally present itself to every reader to whom these considerations are novel. It runs thus. Changes are real. This, the continual change in our own representations, demonstrates, even though the existence of all external phenomena, together with their changes, is denied. Now, changes are only possible in time, and therefore time must be something real. But there is no difficulty in answering this. I grant the whole argument. Time, no doubt, is something real. That is, it is the real form of our internal intuition. It therefore has subjective reality, in reference to our internal experience. That is, I have really the representation of time and of my determinations therein. Time, therefore, is not to be regarded as an object, but as the mode of representation of myself as an object. But if I could intuit myself, or be intuited by another being, without this condition of sensibility, then those very determinations which we now represent to ourselves as changes would present to us a knowledge in which the representation of time, and consequently of change, would not appear. The empirical reality of time, therefore, remains as the condition of all our experience. But absolute reality, according to what has been said above, cannot be granted it. Time is nothing but the form of our internal intuition. See footnote. If we take away from it the special condition of our sensibility, the conception of time also vanishes, and it inheres not in the objects themselves, but solely in the subject or mind which intuits them. Footnote. I can indeed say, my representations follow one another or are successive, but this means only that we are conscious of them as in a succession, that is, according to the form of the internal sense. Time, therefore, is not a thing in itself, nor is it any objective determination pertaining to or inherent in things. But the reason why this objection is so unanimously brought against our doctrine of time, and that too by disputants who cannot start any intelligible arguments against the doctrine of the ideality of space, is this. They have no hope of demonstrating apodeictically the absolute reality of space, because the doctrine of idealism is against them, according to which the reality of external objects is not capable of any strict proof. On the other hand, the reality of the object of our internal sense, that is, myself and my internal state, is clear immediately through consciousness. The former, external objects in space, might be a mere delusion, but the latter, the object of my internal perception, is undeniably real. They do not, however, reflect that both, without question of their reality as representations, belong only to the genus phenomenon which has always two aspects, the one the object considered as a thing in itself, without regard to the mode of intuiting it, and the nature of which remains for this very reason problematical, the other the form of our intuition of the object, which must be sought not in the object as a thing in itself, but in the subject to which it appears. Which form of intuition nevertheless belongs really and necessarily to the phenomenal object. Time and space are therefore two sources of knowledge from which, a priori, various synthetical cognitions can be drawn. Of this we find a striking example in the cognitions of space and its relations which form the foundation of pure mathematics. They are the two pure forms of all intuitions, and thereby make synthetical propositions a priori possible. But these sources of knowledge being merely conditions of our sensibility, do therefore, and as such, strictly determine their own range and purpose, in that they do not and cannot present objects as things in themselves, but are applicable to them solely insofar as they are considered as sensuous phenomena. The sphere of phenomena is the only sphere of their validity, and if we venture out of this, no further objective use can be made of them. For the rest, this formal reality of time and space leaves the validity of our empirical knowledge unshaken, for our certainty in that respect is equally firm, whether these forms necessarily inhere in the things themselves or only in our intuitions of them. On the other hand, those who maintain the absolute reality of time and space, whether as essentially subsisting or only inhering as modifications in things, must find themselves at utter variance with the principles of experience itself. For if they decide for the first view and make space and time into substances, this being the side taken by mathematical natural philosophers, they must admit two self-subsisting non-entities, infinite and eternal, which exist, yet without there being anything real, for the purpose of containing in themselves everything that is real. If they adopt the second view of inherence, which is preferred by some metaphysical natural philosophers, and regard space and time as relations, contiguity in space or succession in time, abstracted from experience, though represented confusedly in this state of separation, they find themselves in that case necessitated to deny the validity of mathematical doctrines a priori in reference to real things, for example, in space. At all events, their apodeictic certainty. For such certainty cannot be found in an a posteriori proposition, and the conceptions a priori of space and time are, according to this opinion, mere creations of the imagination, having their source really in experience, inasmuch as, out of relations abstracted from experience, imagination has made up something which contains, indeed, general statements of these relations, yet of which no application can be made without the restrictions attached thereto by nature. The former of these parties gains this advantage, that they keep the sphere of phenomena free for mathematical science. On the other hand, these very conditions, space and time, embarrass them greatly when the understanding endeavours to pass the limits of that sphere. The latter has, indeed, this advantage, that the representations of space and time do not come in their way when they wish to judge of objects, not as phenomena, but merely in their relation to the understanding. Devoid, however, of a true and objectively valid a priori intuition, they can neither furnish any basis for the possibility of mathematical cognitions a priori, nor bring the propositions of experience into necessary accordance with those of mathematics. In our theory of the true nature of these two original forms of the sensibility, both difficulties are surmounted. In conclusion, that transcendental aesthetics cannot contain any more than these two elements, space and time, is sufficiently obvious from the fact that all other conceptions appertaining to sensibility, even that of motion, which unites in itself both elements, presuppose something empirical. Motion, for example, presupposes the perception of something movable. But space, considered in itself, contains nothing movable. Consequently, motion must be something which is found in space only through experience. In other words, an empirical datum. In like manner, transcendental aesthetic cannot number the conception of change among its data a priori, for time itself does not change, but only something which is in time. To acquire the conception of change, therefore, the perception of some existing object and of the succession of its determinations, in one word, experience, is necessary. SS 9. General Remarks on Transcendental Aesthetic. 1. In order to prevent any misunderstanding, it will be requisite in the first place to recapitulate as clearly as possible what our opinion is with respect to the fundamental nature of our sensuous cognition in general. We have intended, then, to say that all our intuition is nothing but the representation of phenomena, that the things which we intuit are not in themselves the same as our representations of them in intuition, nor are their relations in themselves so constituted as they appear to us, and that if we take away the subject, or even only the subjective constitution of our senses in general, then not only the nature and relations of objects in space and time, but even space and time themselves disappear, and that these, as phenomena, cannot exist in themselves, but only in us. What may be the nature of objects considered as things in themselves and without reference to the receptivity of our sensibility is quite unknown to us. We know nothing more than our mode of perceiving them, which is peculiar to us, and which, though not of necessity pertaining to every animated being, is so to the whole human race. With this alone we have to do. Space and time are the pure forms thereof, sensation the matter. The former alone can we cognize a priori, that is, antecedent to all actual perception, and for this reason such cognition is called pure intuition. The latter is that in our cognition which is called cognition a posteriori, that is, empirical intuition. The former appertain absolutely and necessarily to our sensibility, of whatsoever kind our sensations may be. The latter may be of very diversified character. Supposing that we should carry our empirical intuition even to the very highest degree of clearness, we should not thereby advance one step nearer to a knowledge of the constitution of objects as things in themselves. For we could only, at best, arrive at a complete cognition of our own mode of intuition, that is, of our sensibility, and this always under the conditions originally attaching to the subject, namely, the conditions of space and time, while the question, what are objects considered as things in themselves, remains unanswerable even after the most thorough examination of the phenomenal world. To say, then, that all our sensibility is nothing but the confused representation of things containing exclusively that which belongs to them as things in themselves, and this under an accumulation of characteristic marks and partial representations which we cannot distinguish in consciousness, is a falsification of the conception of sensibility and phenomenization, which renders our whole doctrine thereof empty and useless. The difference between a confused and a clear representation is merely logical and has nothing to do with content. No doubt the conception of right, as employed by a sound understanding, contains all that the most subtle investigation could unfold from it, although, in the ordinary, practical use of the word, we are not conscious of the manifold representations comprised in the conception. But we cannot for this reason assert that the ordinary conception is a sensuous one, containing a mere phenomenon, for right cannot appear as a phenomenon. But the conception of it lies in the understanding, and represents a property, the moral property, of actions, which belongs to them in themselves. On the other hand, the representation in intuition of a body contains nothing which could belong to an object considered as a thing in itself, but merely the phenomenon or appearance of something, and the mode in which we are affected by that appearance. And this receptivity of our faculty of cognition is called sensibility, and remains toto coelo different from the cognition of an object in itself, even though we should examine the content of the phenomenon to the very bottom. It must be admitted that the Leibniz-Wolfian philosophy has assigned an entirely erroneous point of view to all investigations into the nature and origin of our cognitions, inasmuch as it regards the distinction between the sensuous and the intellectual as merely logical, whereas it is plainly transcendental, and concerns not merely the clearness or obscurity, but the content and origin of both. For the faculty of sensibility not only does not present us with an indistinct and confused cognition of objects as things in themselves, but in fact gives us no knowledge of these at all. On the contrary, so soon as we abstract in thought our own subjective nature, the object represented, with the properties ascribed to it by sensuous intuition, entirely disappears, because it was only this subjective nature that determined the form of the object as a phenomenon. In phenomena, we commonly indeed distinguish that which essentially belongs to the intuition of them, and is valid for the sensuous faculty of every human being, from that which belongs to the same intuition accidentally, as valid not for the sensuous faculty in general, but for a particular state or organization of this or that sense. Accordingly, we are accustomed to say that the former is a cognition which represents the object itself, whilst the latter presents only a particular appearance or phenomenon thereof. This distinction, however, is only empirical. If we stop here, as is usual, and do not regard the empirical intuition as itself a mere phenomenon, as we ought to do, in which nothing that can appertain to a thing in itself is to be found, our transcendental distinction is lost, and we believe that we cognize objects as things in themselves, although in the whole range of the sensuous world, investigate the nature of its objects as profoundly as we may, we have to do with nothing but phenomena. Thus, we call the rainbow a mere appearance of phenomenon in a sunny shower, and the rain the reality or thing in itself. And this is right enough if we understand that the latter conception in a merely physical sense, that is, as that which in universal experience and under whatever conditions of sensuous perception is known in intuition to be so and so determined and not otherwise. But if we consider this empirical datum generally and inquire, without reference to its accordance with all our senses, whether there can be discovered in it aught which represents an object as a thing in itself, the raindrops, of course, are not such, for they are, as phenomena, empirical objects, the question of the relation of the representation to the object is transcendental. And not only are the raindrops mere phenomena, but even their circular form, nay, the space itself through which they fall, is nothing in itself, but both are mere modifications or fundamental dispositions of our sensuous intuition, whilst the transcendental object remains for us utterly unknown. The second important concern of our aesthetic is that it does not obtain favour merely as a plausible hypothesis, but possesses as undoubted a character of certainty as can be demanded of any theory which is to serve for an organon. In order fully to convince the reader of this certainty, we shall select a case which will serve to make its validity apparent, and also to illustrate what has been said in SS3. Suppose, then, that space and time are in themselves objective, and conditions of the possibility of objects as things in themselves. In the first place, it is evident that both present us with very many apodeictic and synthetic propositions a priori, but especially space, and for this reason we shall prefer it for investigation at present. As the propositions of geometry are cognized synthetically a priori, and with apodeictic certainty, I inquire, whence do you obtain propositions of this kind, and on what basis does the understanding rest in order to arrive at such absolutely necessary and universally valid truths? There is no other way than through intuitions or conceptions as such, and these are given either a priori or a posteriori. The latter, namely empirical conceptions, together with the empirical intuition on which they are founded, cannot afford any synthetical proposition except such as is itself also empirical, that is, a proposition of experience. But an empirical proposition cannot possess the qualities of necessity and absolute universality, which nevertheless are the characteristics of all geometrical propositions. As to the first and only means to arrive at such cognitions, namely, through mere conceptions or intuitions a priori, it is quite clear that from mere conceptions no synthetical cognitions, but only analytical ones, can be obtained. Take, for example, the proposition, two straight lines cannot enclose a space, and with these alone no figure is possible, and try to deduce from it the conception of a straight line and the number two. Or, take the proposition, it is possible to construct a figure with three straight lines, and endeavour in like manner to deduce from it the mere conception of a straight line and the number three. All your endeavours are in vain, and you find yourself forced to have recourse to intuition, as, in fact, geometry always does. You therefore give yourself an object in intuition. But of what kind is this intuition? Is it a pure a priori, or is it an empirical intuition? If the latter, then neither an universally valid, much less an apodeictic proposition can arise from it, for experience never can give us any such proposition. You must therefore give yourself an object a priori in intuition, and upon that ground your synthetical proposition. Now, if there did not exist within you a faculty of intuition a priori, if this subjective condition were not in respect to its form also the universal condition a priori under which alone the object of this external intuition is itself possible, if the object, that is, the triangle, were something in itself, without relation to you, the subject, how could you affirm that that which lies necessarily in your subjective conditions in order to construct a triangle must also necessarily belong to the triangle in itself? For to your conceptions of three lines you could not add anything new, that is, the figure, which therefore must necessarily be found in the object, because the object is given before your cognition, and not by means of it. If, therefore, space and time also were not a mere form of your intuition, which contains conditions a priori, under which alone things can become external objects for you, and without which subjective conditions the objects are in themselves nothing, you could not construct any synthetical proposition whatsoever regarding external objects. It is therefore not merely possible or probable, but indubitably certain that space and time, as the necessary conditions of all our external and internal experience, are merely subjective conditions of all our intuitions, in relation to which all objects are therefore mere phenomena, and not things in themselves presented to us in this particular manner. And for this reason, in respect to the form of phenomena, much may be said a priori, whilst of the thing in itself, which may lie at the foundation of these phenomena, it is impossible to say anything. 2. In confirmation of this theory of the ideality of the external as well as internal sense, consequently of all objects of sense as mere phenomena, we may especially remark that all in our cognition that belongs to intuition contains nothing more than mere relations. The feelings of pain and pleasure and the will which are not cognitions are excepted. The relations, to wit, of place in an intuition, extension, change of place, motion, and laws according to which this change is determined, moving forces. That, however, which is present in this or that place, or any operation going on, or result taking place in the things themselves, with the exception of change of place, is not given to us by intuition. Now, by means of mere relations, a thing cannot be known in itself, and it may therefore be fairly concluded that, as through the external sense nothing but mere representations of relations are given us, the said external sense in its representation can contain only the relation of the object to the subject, but not the essential nature of the object as a thing in itself. The same is the case with the internal intuition, not only because in the internal intuition the representation of the external senses constitutes the material with which the mind is occupied, but because time, in which we place and which itself antecedes the consciousness of these representations in experience, and which, as the formal condition of the mode according to which objects are placed in the mind, lies at the foundation of them, contains relations of the successive, the coexistent, and of that which always must be coexistent with succession, the permanent. Now that which, as representation, can antecede every existence of thought of an object is intuition. And when it contains nothing but relations, it is the form of the intuition which, as it presents us with no representation, except in so far as something is placed in the mind, can be nothing else than the mode in which the mind is affected by its own activity, to wit, its presenting to itself representations, consequently, the mode in which the mind is affected by itself. That is, it can be nothing but an internal sense in respect to its form. Everything that is represented through the medium of sense is so far phenomenal. Consequently, we must either refuse altogether to admit an internal sense, or the subject, which is the object of that sense, could only be represented by it as phenomenon, and not as it would judge of itself if its intuition were pure spontaneous activity, that is, were intellectual. The difficulty here lies wholly in the question, how can the subject have an internal intuition of itself? But this difficulty is common to every theory. The consciousness of self, apperception, is the simple representation of the ego, and if by means of that representation alone all the manifold representations in the subject were spontaneously given, then our internal intuition would be intellectual. This consciousness in man requires an internal perception of the manifold representations which are previously given in the subject, and the manner in which these representations are given in the mind without spontaneity must, on account of this difference, the want of spontaneity, be called sensibility. If the faculty of self-consciousness is to apprehend what lies in the mind, it must all act that, and can in this way alone produce an intuition of self. But the form of this intuition, which lies in the original constitution of the mind, determines, in the representation of time, the manner in which the manifold representations are to combine themselves in the mind. since the subject intuits itself not as it would represent itself immediately and spontaneously, but according to the manner in which the mind is internally affected, consequently as it appears and not as it is. 3. When we say that the intuition of external objects and also the self-intuition of the subject represent both objects and subject in space and time as they affect our senses, that is, as they appear, this is by no means equivalent to asserting that these objects are mere illusory appearances. For when we speak of things as phenomena, the objects, nay, even the properties which we ascribe to them, are looked upon as really given. Only that, insofar as this or that property depends on the mode of intuition of the subject, in the relation of the given object to the subject, the object as phenomenon is to be distinguished from the object as a thing in itself. Thus I do not say that bodies seem or appear to be external to me, or that my soul seems merely to be given in my self-consciousness, although I maintain that the properties of space and time, in conformity to which I set both as the condition of their existence, abide in my mode of intuition and not in the objects in themselves. It would be my own fault if out of that which I should reckon as phenomenon I made mere illusory appearance. See footnote. But this will not happen because of our principle of the ideality of all sensuous intuitions. On the contrary, if we ascribe objective reality to these forms of representation, it becomes impossible to avoid changing everything into mere appearance. For if we regard space and time as properties which must be found in objects as things in themselves, as sine quibus non of the possibility of their existence, and reflect on the absurdities in which we then find ourselves involved, inasmuch as we are compelled to admit the existence of two infinite things, which are nevertheless not substances, nor anything really inhering in substances, nay, to admit that they are the necessary conditions of the existence of all things, and moreover that they must continue to exist, although all existing things were annihilated, we cannot blame the good Berkeley for degrading bodies to mere illusory appearances. Nay, even our own existence, which would in this case depend upon the self-existent reality of such a mere non-entity as time, would necessarily be changed with it into mere appearance, an absurdity which no one has as yet been guilty of. Footnote. The predicates of the phenomenon can be affixed to the object itself in relation to our sensuous faculty. For example, the red color or the perfume to the rose. But illusory appearance never can be attributed as a predicate to an object, for this very reason, that it attributes to this object in itself that which belongs to it only in relation to our sensuous faculty, or to the subject in general, e.g., the two handles which were formerly ascribed to Saturn. That which is never to be found in the object itself, but always in the relation of the object to the subject, and which moreover is inseparable from our representation of the object, we denominate phenomenon. Thus, the predicates of space and time are rightly attributed to objects of the senses as such, and in this there is no illusion. On the contrary, if I ascribe redness of the rose as a thing in itself, or to Saturn his handles, or extension to all external objects, considered as things in themselves, without regarding the determinate relation of these objects to the subject, and without limiting my judgment to that relation, then, and then only, arises illusion. 4. In natural theology, where we think of an object, God, which never can be an object of intuition to us, and even to himself can never be an object of sensuous intuition, we carefully avoid attributing to his intuition the conditions of space and time. And intuition all his cognition must be, and not thought, which always includes limitation. But with what right can we do this if we make them forms of objects as things in themselves, and such, moreover, as would continue to exist as a priori conditions of the existence of things, even though the things themselves were annihilated? For as conditions of all existence in general, space and time must be conditions of the existence of the Supreme Being also. But if we do not thus make them objective forms of all things, there is no other way left than to make them subjective forms of our mode of intuition, external and internal, which is called sensuous because it is not primitive, that is not such as gives in itself the existence of the object of the intuition, a mode of intuition which, so far as we can judge, can belong only to the Creator, but is dependent on the existence of the object, is possible, therefore, only on condition that the representative faculty of the subject is affected by the object. It is, moreover, not necessary that we should limit the mode of intuition in space and time to the sensuous faculty of man. It may well be that all finite thinking beings must necessarily in this respect agree with man, although as to this we cannot decide, but sensibility does not on account of this universality cease to be sensibility, for this very reason, that it is a deduced, intuitus derivativus, and not an original, intuitus originarius, consequently not an intellectual intuition. And this intuition as such, for reasons above mentioned, seems to belong solely to the Supreme Being, but never to a being dependent, quoad its existence as well as its intuition, which its existence determines and limits relatively to given objects. This latter remark, however, must be taken only as an illustration, and not as any proof of the truth of our aesthetical theory. SS 10. Conclusion of the Transcendental Aesthetic. We have now completely before us one part of the solution of the grand general problem of transcendental philosophy, namely the question, how are synthetical propositions a priori possible? That is to say, we have shown that we are in possession of pure a priori intuitions, namely space and time, in which we find, when in a judgment a priori we pass out beyond the given conception, something which is not discoverable in that conception, but is certainly found a priori in the intuition which corresponds to the conception, and can be united synthetically with it. But the judgments which these pure intuitions enable us to make never reach farther than to objects of the senses, and are valid only for objects of possible experience. Second part. Transcendental Logic. Introduction. Idea of Transcendental Logic. 1. Of Logic in General. Our knowledge springs from two main sources in the mind. First of which is the faculty or power of receiving representations, receptivity for impressions. The second is the power of cognizing by means of these representations, spontaneity in the production of conceptions. Through the first, an object is given to us. Through the second, it is, in relation to the representation, which is a mere determination of the mind, thought. Intuition and conceptions constitute, therefore, the elements of all our knowledge, so that neither conceptions without an intuition in some way corresponding to them, nor intuition without conceptions can afford us a cognition. Both are either pure or empirical. They are empirical when sensation, which presupposes the actual presence of the object, is contained in them, and pure when no sensation is mixed with the representation. Sensations we may call the matter of sensuous cognition. Pure intuition consequently contains merely the form under which something is intuited, and pure conception only the form of the thought of an object. Only pure intuitions and pure conceptions are possible a priori, the empirical only a posteriori. We apply the term sensibility to the receptivity of the mind for impressions, insofar as it is in some way affected. And, on the other hand, we call the faculty of spontaneously producing representations or the spontaneity of cognition understanding. Our nature is so constituted that intuition with us never can be other than sensuous, that is, it contains only the mode in which we are affected by objects. On the other hand, the faculty of thinking the object of sensuous intuition is the understanding. Neither of these faculties has a preference over the other. Without the sensuous faculty, no object would be given to us, and without the understanding, no object would be thought. Thoughts without content are void, intuitions without conceptions blind. Hence it is as necessary for the mind to make its conceptions sensuous, that is, to join to them the object in intuition, as to make its intuitions intelligible, that is, to bring them under conceptions. Neither of these faculties can exchange its proper function. Understanding cannot intuit, and the sensuous faculty cannot think. In no other way than from the united operation of both can knowledge arise. But no one ought on this account to overlook the difference of the elements contributed by each. We have rather great reason carefully to separate and distinguish them. We therefore distinguish the science of the laws of sensibility, that is, aesthetic, from the science of the laws of the understanding, that is, logic. Now logic in its turn may be considered as twofold, namely, as logic of the general or of the particular use of the understanding. The first contains the absolutely necessary laws of thought, without which no use whatsoever of the understanding is possible, and gives laws therefore to the understanding without regard to the difference of objects on which it may be employed. The logic of the particular use of the understanding